I'm Chris Williamson. I was a member of the Labour Party for nearly 43 years, former Labour MP and leader of the council in Derby, where I'm from. And I was very close to Jeremy Corbyn, worked very hard in his leadership campaign, both of them. And when I got re-elected to Parliament in 2017, after carelessly losing my seat in 2015, was his loudest and most dedicated champion in Parliament.
Now, we've heard from Keir Starmer that Jeremy will be suspended at the moment, I believe, from the Labour Party. He won't be allowed to stand as a candidate for the Labour Party in his Islington seat.
Yeah, I mean, well, he's not suspended from the Labour Party. He was suspended, but then he was reinstated. But he's in this rather twilight zone situation at the moment, where he's a member of the Labour Party and an MP, but not actually a Labour MP, because the whip has been, so the Labour whip has been suspended by Sir Keir Starmer. So if he hasn't got the whip, then he will not be allowed to stand as a Labour candidate at the next general election. But that, frankly, was always on the cards right from the get-go.
If he's been suspended from the party, and then reinstated, well, how come the whip has not been restored?
Well, that's a very good question. But the leader of the party has the power, which he's exercised, to withdraw the whip from any member of the parliamentary party, and that's what he's done. But, you know, I mean, I think Jeremy's way back into, formally into the Labour, parliamentary Labour Party was never really on the cards, to be honest with you. And I think what Jeremy should have done from the outset, really, is to say, you know, a plague on your house, Sir Keir, and I'm going to branch out on my own. I mean, I've actually messaged Jeremy following this announcement from Sir Keir Starmer yesterday, to suggest that he considers joining with myself in the Socialist Labour Party to help us to sort of rejuvenate it. I mean, it was established, the Socialist Labour Party, back in 1996 by Arthur Scoggins and others, after Tony Blair had jettisoned the historic commitment that the Labour Party had in its constitution to, as it were, replace capitalism when they, you know, abolished Clause 4. But it's been pretty moribund for a few years, and a number of us have joined it. The resist movements joined in with the Socialist Labour Party, and we're hoping to rejuvenate it. So I've suggested to Jeremy that perhaps Socialist lot in with us, or maybe joins together with George Galloway in the Workers' Party. I mean, the Socialist Labour Party and the Workers' Party are collaborating at the moment, for example, to build this movement to oppose NATO and the ongoing war in Ukraine, which could indeed lead, if we're not very careful, to a escalation into a Third World War and a possible nuclear holocaust. So it is possible, I think, for us to, you know, people outside the party to collaborate on the left, and I think that's the way forward. And Jeremy holds a lot of sway with, you know, with hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. And I think if he were to do that, or even, you know, set something up on his own, you know, a lot of people would follow. I mean, the danger for me, I think, is, you know, a Sir Keir Starmer-led Labour government would be a huge disappointment to a lot of people who think they might, you know, change things much, because they wouldn't. And then my fear is that he'd be even more authoritarian than the Conservative governments are at the moment.
So you messaged him. Any reply?
Not yet. But we'll see.
You talking about Corbyn's support, I think you're right in saying the millions, because of the hundreds of thousands of people that actually joined the Labour Party under him.
Yes, that's very true. I mean, and frankly, I think if Jeremy had stood up to his detractors, we did actually on a lot of them, and when they were accusing him of being a Czech spy and a misogynist and all these ridiculous, absurd accusations that they were making against him. And, you know, he saw them off in, you know, in double quick time. However, he gave ground to and yielded to this offensive accusation that, you know, he was some sort of anti-Semite and he was enabling anti-Semitism. And because he continued to give ground and apologise, and I said this to Jeremy, I said this to the Socialist Campaign Group, that all you're doing is feeding the beast and making it stronger, and they're just going to keep coming back for more. You know, the more victims that are thrown under the bus, you know, the more they'll keep coming back, until eventually they go for you, Jeremy, and this whole project is destroyed. And that's what's happened, of course. So, you know, it's a very sad state of affairs, but, you know, we are where we are now, and I think we need to, you know, Jeremy needs to sort of take stock and move forward, and you know, his best bet, in my opinion, is to not just simply stand as an independent. I think, you know, because of the support that Jeremy has, the influence that he's got, in the country, would indeed, I think, may make a big difference if he were to throw his lot in with one of the two parties I've mentioned, or indeed, set something up himself. But, had he not yielded in the way that he did, I think that the Labour Party, the membership grew to over 600,000. I mean, it could have gone well over 1 million, I think. But we ended up getting distracted by this nonsense, by the thing that really derailed the whole project was the anti-Semitism scam, frankly, and that fundamentally weakened the party. And then the thing that kind of sealed it off was the ridiculous commitment to a second EU referendum, and that just finished it off. The rest is history, as they say. We are where we are now, and we've got to rebuild, start again.
Now, the public relations side of this, I find very bizarre, because clearly this sort of thing, what announcement was going to be made by Starmer, this shouldn't have come as any surprise to Jeremy. And I'm quite amazed that he didn't ride this wave of publicity by making his own announcement saying, well, this is what I'm doing, I'm countering it. He almost seems to be dithering, because PR, as we know, and the way that these things are reacted to and spun in the press is key. So if he'd had an announcement yesterday, in a way that would have kind of bounced this whole issue straight back into Starmer's face. So what's going on with his PR? Does he have no PR advice? Is he just every time something happens? It seems to me, I'm saying here, Chris, is that he's never taking the initiative. He's always waiting for things to be done to him and never trying to counter them, at least until maybe it's too late.
Well, I mean, that's been the story, isn't it, right from the get-go, really, or certainly from the start of the whole anti-Semitism scam, if I can put it like that. Jeremy never took the initiative on that, and was on the back foot all the way through. I mean, frankly, I think just in relation to this, it certainly would have been a huge opportunity, I think, to say, right, okay, fine, I am going to fight this election now. And indeed, even better if if he were to say, well, and furthermore, I'm going to be joining forces with George Galloway and in the Workers' Party, or I'm going to be joining forces with Chris Williamson and Arthur Scargill in the Socialist Labour Party, and we're going to build this alternative movement. But I think he could have done that. Jeremy could have done that. He would have seized the initiative when Keir Starmer withdrew the whip or refused to reinstate the whip after Jeremy had gone through the process of a disciplinary hearing. I mean, he had to go through the indignity of that. But I mean, at least that panel did reinstate him. I mean, it's quite offensive, frankly, and utterly insulting for somebody who, had led the party, had served the party. I mean, had been a member of the party for 50-odd years, member of parliament for 40 years, a leader of the party, somebody who had secured his leadership, the biggest increase in vote share since 1945, had utterly rejuvenated the party, rejuvenated interest in politics, and wiped out the party's massive multi-million pound deficit because of all of the new members that were joining, not through big donors like Tony Blair and Gordon Brown went for, multi-millionaire, billionaires and so on, giving the party money. It was through small contributions from ordinary rank of our members. No thanks for that whatsoever. Just unceremoniously ditched because of, Sir Keir Starmer, the people around him, the right wing of the Labour Party, are totally enthrall to the establishment, to neoliberal economics, to the war machine. I mean, that's the reality of it. What Jeremy lacked was any ruthlessness to actually deal with these characters. What Jeremy should have done is got behind the democracy forms that I was spearheading and held these people properly to account, given members much greater control of the party, and ensured that these people would either, abide by the democratically arrived at policies of the party, or they would be out on the rear. It was Ed Miliband who said in 2010, when he was standing for the Labour leadership, that if we'd listened to our members a bit more, we wouldn't have made as many mistakes when we were in government. And he's absolutely right. If they'd listened to the members, we wouldn't have had tuition fees. We wouldn't have had the war in Iraq. We wouldn't have had cuts in social security benefits. We wouldn't have started to see private health care in the National Health Service. The privatisation of the NHS was just started under a Labour government. I mean, it's just something you couldn't make it up, really. And of course, all that was jettisoned. But then Jeremy was such a breath of fresh air. And, it did seem that we were going to be, embarking on a completely new way of doing politics. I mean, unfortunately, then after that 2017 election, which was the best result we could have achieved, frankly, because if we'd have won in 2017 with that appalling parliamentary Labour Party, Jeremy wouldn't have been able to deliver the programme that most of the country wanted and the absolutely overwhelming majority of the party members wanted, because it would have been a sabotage by them. So he could have pushed through the democracy reforms, and these people would have been brought to heel, and would have brought, you know, some new blood in, and that would have inspired people, and the membership would have continued to grow, and as I said, would have got, you know, I believe, you know, well over a million or even more. There's huge potential because people were so inspired by this complete breath of fresh air.
Chris, you seem to be dismissing this anti-Semitism scandal as if there was nothing there. There clearly was something there.
No, well, I disagree. I mean, it was infinitesimally small, and the figures prove that. I mean, when it was looked at and researched, they could only come up with, I think, I mean, I've written a book, you know, 10 Years Hard Labour. I think they've reviewed it on your show. I actually go into this in some detail, but the actual number of people who were expelled for anti-Semitism was something like 0.004%. And then when you actually examine, well, who were those people that were expelled? Who were those, that 0.004%? I mean, I might be wrong on that figure, but it was of that order. They included somebody who was the son, a Jewish man, born in Israel, served in the Israeli army, saw the light, you know, moved to this country, became a very strong pro-Palestinian campaigner, big supporter of Jeremy Corbyn. He was included in that statistic, you know, a Jewish man whose parents survived Auschwitz. Another one was a son of a rabbi. Another one was the daughter of two people who had suffered at the hands of the McCarthyite witch hunt. These are Jewish people I'm talking about here. So, you know, the whole thing was made up. It was weaponized. It was a scam. It was used to undermine Jeremy Corbyn. And, you know, Jeremy and the people around him, they facilitated that by continually apologizing and prostrating themselves before Zionist organizations like the, you know, the so-called Board of Deputies, which claims to represent all Jews in this country. They do not. They represent, it might represent about 30% or so, because many, many Jewish people that I know are very, very hostile to Israel. Israel even as a concept, actually, but certainly hostile to the regime. They're very strongly anti-Zionist. And this whole thing was about two things, really. One, they couldn't tolerate, the Israeli state couldn't tolerate somebody who was a leader of the opposition, let alone the, you know, potential prime minister, who was you know, pro-Palestinian, opposed to Zionism, and basically would call Israel out for what it actually is, an apartheid fascist state. The establishment, you know, who were concerned about, you know, a possible kind of socialist domestic program. And of course, the military industrial complex couldn't countenance somebody who appointed a minister for peace and disarmament, a permanent member of the UN Security Council, promoting peace and disarmament around the world instead of war and arms sales. That was unconscionable. And so, you know, you've got this unholy alliance of powerful forces who came together to smash the Corbyn project on the pretext that, you know, there was a major problem with a crisis of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. It's utter nonsense. I never ever witnessed anti-Semitism in 43 years as a Labour Party member. I speak to Jewish colleagues and they say they never have experienced anti-Semitism. And I spoke to one guy, mid-party, a bit longer than me, 50-odd years. He said, well, yeah, there was one occasion in 1970 I did come across an anti-Semitic incident. It just wasn't true. It wasn't true at all,
but I will say,
but it was ruthlessly and mercilessly, you know, weaponized, and you know, it's people.
In my 30 years in journalism, the only time I ever experienced anti-Semitism within political circles, open anti-Semitism, was actually within a right-wing conservative.
Oh yes, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I'm not clearly anti-Semitism exists. It's an evil, of course it is. You know, look, and you know, people like me. I mean, I was one of the first members of the Anti-Nazi League in the 1970s, at the, you know, during the rise of the Fascist National Front, which was a, you know, potentially a real threat back in those days. You know, I fought literally, you know, fascists and racists and anti-Semites on the streets, literally, you know, fought them. And on building sites, I used to work in the building trade, you know, and racism was a casual thing then amongst society. And, you know, more than a few occasions, nearly got my head kicked in for challenging casual racism. So then to, you know, be then, you know, accused of being an anti-Semite and facilitating anti-Semitism, etc. I mean, it was a complete, you know, and it was a complete insult, actually, a really offensive thing to say. And, this is obviously something that Jeremy felt very, very hurt by, actually. And I think it kind of, it sort of paralyzed him,
Yeah,
really.
well,
And,
it certainly seems to have done. It see also, speaking to Jews, many of them are actually rather annoyed. Well, more than annoyed, because what this kind of fake anti-Semitism does is it trivializes the real anti-Semitism. In
course it
fact,
does.
what it's doing, it's trivializing actually the kind of Nazi mentality that says that there's Untermensch, Übermensch, this Nietzschean idea that you've got these supermen that just rule everyone in this authoritarian manner, like Adolf Hitler's beliefs, and it trivializes them.
Well, of course it does. I mean, look, and the anti-Semitism, as I've said, it exists, but it's on the outer reaches of the far right. Actually, that's where it emanates from. It's from the white supremacists, the kind of Nazis, etc. The irony is, of course, that many Zionists actually, work closely with far right groups and so on. I mean, this is true. Even going right back, and this is one of the things that Ken Livingstone got into trouble for mentioning the Havara Agreement, the Havara Transfer Agreement, where German Zionists made a pact with the Nazis to transfer wealthy Jewish German citizens out of Germany into Palestine. And of course, we saw then John Mann assailing Ken in the street, accusing him of being a Nazi apologist. But Ken was absolutely right about this. I mean, Tony Greenstein, another Jewish former member of the Labour Party, was expelled, whose father fought the Oswald Mosley's fascists at the Battle of Cable Street in 1936. Has written a book recently, actually, about Zionism, during the Nazi era. And it's fascinating reading, actually, to sort of see that.
Yeah,
But yeah, I mean,
just to say
so
the
some
title.
curious hookups there, yeah.
Yeah, the title is Zionism During the Holocaust. Certainly
That's right, yeah.
well worth a read. But
Yeah.
anyway, look, as someone who's been in the Labour Party for a long time yourself, what do you make of Keir Starmer? Because I think the odds are we are almost certainly going to see a Starmer government if he's still leader. The Labour Party, the Conservatives are making such a mess of everything. I mean, literally, we've had today the Centrica profits, 3 billion. We've had BP profits, 23 billion. We've had Shell profits, 30 something billion. What's happening is the energy companies are basically just ruling the roost. They are running the show, and they are shoveling our wealth into their shareholders' pockets. But the Goldman Sachs, ex-Goldman Sachs Prime Minister Rishi Sunak seems to be doing absolutely nothing about it. So it almost seems like people are just going to get fed up with this cost of living crisis, particularly as the help that people are being given over this winter sort of fades away next winter, where it's almost going to be a shoo-in for Keir Starmer. What do you think that government might look like? Is it going to be something that working people can really vote for?
Absolutely not. I mean, it'll be very similar to what we've got at the moment. I mean, he's in the pockets of the corporate elite. He's an establishment stooge. He's, a member of the Shady Trilateral Commission, established in the early 1970s by well-placed liberals who were concerned about what they referred to as an excess of democracy in the 1960s, where the civil rights movement and anti-war movements in the United States, and he rubs shoulders with war criminals like Henry Kissinger. This is a shady organization that doesn't publish minutes of its meetings, etc. I mean, what on earth is a man who's leader of a so-called Democratic Party doing involved in an organization that's concerned about an excess of democracy? There's been no real change. They're both signed up. Both parties are signed up to neoliberal economics. There'd be no bringing the utilities into public ownership. I mean, some crumbs from the table talking about, some windfall taxes or whatever, and some sort of a cap on fuel bills. I mean, very similar to what this government's done. I mean, what you need is a root and branch reform. This is something that Jeremy Corbyn was proposing, and is indeed incredibly popular, both with not just Labour supporters, but with conservatives as well. So no, people are going to be sorely disappointed if they think there's going to be much change. And in fact, in many ways, you know, it could be a much more authoritarian government even than this particular government has actually been. His record as the director of public prosecutions, you know, fills me with dread, to be honest with you, in terms of the sort of approach that he would take on issues of civil liberties and free speech and so on. So no, it's not a government. It's not a party that people, in my opinion, should get behind. It's not going to change things fundamentally. Things will stay the same. That's why the establishment's getting behind him. That's why he's getting such an easy ride in the media, because they see him as a safe pair of hands. We'll give the illusion of democratic choice by electing a Labour government with Sir Keir Starmer, who's not going to change anything. There'll be some kind of, you know, little tweaks here and there at the edges, but fundamentally things will stay the same. The neoliberal economic proposition will not be disturbed. The war machine will continue untrammeled. So, you know, things are not going to get better, and they're not with a Sir Keir Starmer led Labour government. Our only hope, frankly, is to build an alternative. I mean, and I'm hopeful with movements like the Enough is Enough movement and the trade unions sort of exerting their power. If people recognize the power of, you know, collective solidarity, if the working class stand together, then we are incredibly powerful. Then we can make real change. And, you know, that's what frightened the establishment to death with what Jeremy Corbyn was proposing. But of course, Jeremy got this great plaudits from ordinary rank and file people up and down the country, and then went back into the House of Parliament, where, you know, it was such a hostile environment there. And unfortunately, the people around Jeremy prioritised managing the parliamentary Labour Party, managing, you know, parliamentary politics, rather than building this social movement, which I think was a massive mistake, and then didn't actually follow through on actually, you know, making sure we brought in democratic reforms to hold these characters to account.
No, that's right. So we had over successive prime minister's questions, we have heard discussion about Ukraine, but it seems very strange to me to hear a Labour Party that is not opposing in any way the conservative support for Zelensky and the Ukrainians in a war effectively against a superpower, which certainly we could never win, and it's very unlikely that Ukraine could ever win. So I'm quite amazed by the lack of reality in these discussions, and also, of course, the lack of opposition. In fact, it's not just the only issue, but it's probably the most important one, that there needs to be opposition in the Houses of Parliament too. If you go to the United States, obviously, you've got a Democratic president there in the House of Representatives and the Congress. You're seeing real serious pushback by the Republican Party, who are now saying, well, actually, we want a vote here to stop all aid, all financial aid for Ukraine. And so there is a real democratic debate going on in the United States, but not here, Chris. So I understand you're going to be part of a meeting coming up soon to make some of these points in London, but also that you had some problems with the venue. So can you just take us through what that's about and whether you've actually found a roof over your head for your talk in London?
Yes, I can, of course. I mean, it's an abdication of responsibility, it seems to me, that there are no parliamentary voices calling for, you know, reason to prevail, calling for peace, calling for diplomacy to bring an end to this terrible war, which is, you know, killing tens of thousands of people, displacing millions of people, causing terrible misery for people. But those voices are completely silent in Parliament. And you even have the so-called socialist campaign group, where in the past you would have expected those to have aired concerns about war and about the need to, you know, promote peace. I mean, the sort of agenda that Jeremy Corbyn was pushing, they're not saying anything. I mean, a dozen of them, I think, signed a fairly tame stop the war statement about the war in Ukraine, which was critical of both Russia and NATO. And they were ordered to remove their name, and within 24 hours they did. And just last week, I think it was John McDonnell, former shadow chancellor, said that the pathway to peace is to send more arms to Ukraine. It's kind of quite incredible I mean, you know, talk about going through the looking glass. So, yeah, that's a real tragedy that we don't have any of those, you know, pro-peace, pro, you know, diplomacy as opposed to more war. I mean, you know, even Winston Churchill said, you know, George war is better than war, but I guess even he would not be allowed to, you know, utter such a proposal or phrase in the modern parliament. But as a consequence of that, yes, I mean, we, you know, we I'm involved with an organization called No to NATO, No to War, and we're trying to organize a rally to bring people together to mount a campaign against it. We've had a terrible difficulty trying to find a venue. We booked one venue. They were then piled on and were intimidated into cancelling us. So we then booked the Conway Hall, which has a reputation going back nearly 100 years of hosting radical and progressive meetings there. You know, Communist Party had met there, you know, various kind of progressive left-wing bodies had met there. Jeremy Corbyn's mother and father met in the 1930s at Conway Hall at a rally about the Spanish Civil War. But they've even actually, in the interest of free speech in the 1970s, hosted a meeting of the National Front, the Fascist National Front. But when we tried to book it, well, in fact, we did book it and they accepted our booking, and we told them that we'd been cancelled by the previous venue. And we said that, look, when we go public with this, are you okay for us to go public with the venue? Because you'll get some pushback, and they were very happy for us to do that. Then when we did, they, you know, they got piled on, and they said that they were subjected to an unprecedented, I think it was the words to the effect of an unprecedented avalanche of intimidation. No, an unprecedented onslaught of intimidation, I think was the term that they used. And they said that they were fearful for the safety of their staff and their building. And so they cancelled us. But we've now found another venue, and we are not announcing that given what's happened until the last moment. So, yeah, I mean, we're keen to kind of build a move. Well, I think there's a lot of people out there who are
Sorry, Chris,
concerned
can I
because,
just, can
of
I just
course.
interrupt you there? Because surely a venue like Conway Hall should understand if they're being intimidated, this is a matter for the Metropolitan Police.
Precisely, and this is what I said to them. But not only have they, as far as I know, not reported the people who are engaged in the intimidation, they actually were threatening us with legal action for having the temerity to point out that they'd cancelled and that you know we produced a screenshot of the letter that they sent to us cancelling us, and then they threatened us with defamation. I mean, it's an absurd state of affairs, you know. So yeah. It's a crazy topsy-turvy world that we're living in at the moment. But, you know, we're determined to press ahead with this campaign. And as I say, there is a lot of support, I think, out there. People are hoping that wiser heads will prevail because, look, this could escalate into a third world war and the potential nuclear holocaust. I mean, we are literally facing an existential crisis here, literally. But people, you know, you would never know that from the corporate news coverage, who are just, I mean, basically they're NATO stenographers. It's quite appalling. I mean, where are the real journalists these days in the corporate media? They don't exist.
Okay, so can you just tell us where and when, or not, obviously not necessarily where, the idea is you book your train ticket to London or however you want to get there, but you find out only at the last minute. It's almost, you know, it reminds me of the rave days, Chris, where you know,
so, yeah,
used to get
some of the organisers, who I think were involved in raves, have said exactly that. Actually, yes, yeah, we're going to have to do it. We're going to organise it like an old fashioned rave. Yeah, I was never involved. That was a bit, you know, after my time. Actually, I'm a kid of the 1970s. You know, I was a soul boy. You know, so we never really. And have had those raves and things like that in the 1970s. But yeah, no, indeed, absolutely that. Yeah, so it will be in central London. It's on the 25th of February. It's an all-day event, and it's not too far from Euston Station.
Okay, so that's seven. That's yes. Whereabouts? It's a Saturday, isn't it?
Saturday. That's a Saturday, the 25th of February. Yeah,
Saturday week. An all-day event, you say, so starting roughly what time?
About 11 o'clock.
Until?
Round six.
Okay. All right, Chris Williamson, thanks very much for joining us.
No worries, all the best.